Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
Tacitus, the prominent Roman historian and orator, spoke of the importance of having a proper mindset. In more recent times, Strother Martin and Paul Newman's characters in Cool Hand Luke discussed getting your mind right. Few would question the importance of mindset when approaching complex and complicated topics like healthcare. The difficulty comes in how to do that. Thankfully, we have an expert to help us. Getting your mind right, next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Michael Hine. Dr. Hine is an internist that has served in a variety of administrative positions, including chief medical officer and CEO of a regional health network. Dr. Hine has spent over 35 years coaching elite athletes, including NCAA All-Americans and national champions. Michael Hine, welcome to Sound Practice.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. Dr. Hine, you've had a long and varied career. Can you describe your path to becoming a physician leader?
Well, as you mentioned, I started off as a competitive swimming and diving coach. I coached club in high school and college for about 10 years before I, as my mother said, finally grew up and decided to become a physician. And I am a general internal medicine doc. And I think like many of the physician leaders and undoubtedly those that are in your audience, the journey or the pattern that I've learned over the years that we as physicians tend to get into leadership is sort of by happenstance. And that means I was just one of those docs, not always happily, but usually willing to participate in what was going on, particularly with the hospital in my day. And I was on committees and, you know, volunteered to do medical director things. And I don't know how many different medical director roles I've had over the years. And I always was doing that. Even when I was a resident, I participated as a representative for residents and medical students. So that was just part of the way I was with the training. And then when I was in my 40s, I grew weary of being on call. And an opportunity to be a half-time administrative leader and half-time clinician. I will just say this to all of my colleagues, there's no such thing as half-time clinical work and half-time leadership. So it really was two jobs. And that was in the VA healthcare system. And I think many of us have quite a few thoughts about that, the VA, but I loved the VA. I loved its mission. They invested heavily in my leadership, and I was as surprised as anyone that I fell in love with leadership. I loved being a clinician, and over the years, it turned out I love being a leader and administrative leader more. I don't know that makes me an anomaly, but that's the truth of it. And over the years, I did less and less clinical work and more administrative work until I was a full-time administrative leader. Later in my career as CMO and CEO, as you mentioned. And along the way, I started a startup company with a couple of fellas, and that company ultimately went on to be sold in a publicly traded company. And now at the end of my career, unexpectedly, I didn't plan on doing this, but when I stepped out of being a CEO because of things that were going on in my life at the time, I sort of stumbled upon being an executive leadership coach, and I've been doing that now for almost 9 years, full time. If you had asked me if I would, you know, like I said, I would never have guessed I would be doing this, but I love the work. And I get to spend every day with leaders all around the country, all levels of leaders, and have been, you know, by at this point, hundreds and hundreds of leaders across U.S. healthcare. That's my journey.
Well, what neither you nor I described is that you're also an author, and you have a new book, Shifting Towards an Orthodoxy. Why'd you write the book?
That's a great question. There's no straightforward or simple answer. If I were to distill it into the main reason, is all those years of working as a leader and clinician, I found being on the receiving end, if you will, of leadership difficult and challenging. And I found being a leader difficult and challenging. And over the years, I just came to the belief that it's hard. It's hard work. And maybe I was too simple-minded enough to let go of that question that haunted me in a way. Why is it so hard? Like, I could just never find a good answer to that. And I wasn't, some folks around me just say, it's hard, deal with it. But I couldn't do that. So the book is really the end result of years of asking that question, what makes healthcare so difficult for all of us, and leadership in particular? And I believe that I've landed, or in many of us, there's other folks that have too, have landed on this notion of complexity as an explanation, perhaps, for part of the reason why it's so difficult. And I just wanted to write about that. It's an invitation for folks to consider other ways of thinking about leadership, and an introduction to this notion of complexity and how that might apply to human organizing activities like leading a healthcare organization.
The book's excellent. And when I read the preface of Shifting Towards Unorthodoxy, I came across your statement that human suffering there's human suffering in healthcare leadership. Can you describe some of the causes of that suffering, and as well as some of the consequences of it?
I'll start with the consequences. It's rather sobering through my eyes. We do talk about burnout, and it's a real thing. But I think sometimes, this is my own personal view, it paints over what's going on. Burnout harms us. It destroys our health, physical and mental health. It oftentimes can lead to destroyed relationships that matter to us. It leads to the end of careers. After you've invested decades of your time and energy, and healthcare needs great leaders. So that's what I mean by suffering. And I don't think it's not just limited to physicians. I think I see it everywhere in healthcare. The workforce, the high degree of turnover, the difficulty in us staffing hospital organizations. And you know, the turnover in executive leadership is super high as well. And all of that, in my view, is a form of suffering. I think in the book, I advanced this idea. Part of why we're suffering the way we are is because we have this belief about what organizations are and how they function that's sort of anchored in the industrial age. And we're still leading organizations as if they're giant machines. And the only way you can lead an organization, a group of people, as if they're a giant machine, is if you try to control them, telling them what to do, how to do it, when to do it. And the consequence over time is that people lose their sense of autonomy, and that never feels good. And I think that's contributing a lot to the suffering that I see around me.
Your book focuses upon mindset. What is a mindset, and why does it matter?
Yeah, so for me, there's quite a bit of popular literature around mindset, and there's some authors that have gained quite a bit of traction in the world. Some people might be familiar with this notion of a growth mindset, for example. That's a pretty popular notion. In the book, I spend some time describing what we mean by mindset. When I say we, me, my colleagues around, is this collection, a set of, if you will, mental models, paradigms, beliefs that we all hold. And those mindsets around topics or issues, they shape the way we think. And that matters because the way we think determines what we do. So if I think being a great leader is to be a hero, then I will look for the right answer to every situation. And that's how I will show up and communicate with people. But if I think or believe that a leader is a gardener, I'm going to show up differently. I'm going to behave differently and make different behavioral choices. So mindsets come before thinking. Thinking determines actions. Actions determine results. That's how I would briefly describe what mindsets are.
Shifting mindsets, I think, can be uncomfortable for people. Are some people naturally better at this than others? And if so, why?
That's a great question. To your intuition, shifting mindset is hard work. First off, they're oftentimes obscure to us. We don't even know we're carrying them or where they came from. And so to even begin to shift, you have to see them and have some awareness about where they might have come from for you. The second thing that makes it difficult that springs to mind for me is that these are connected to how you think the world or the universe operates. They are close to our deeply held beliefs about what is real. And so for some folks, if they have some awareness, to shift a mindset means exploring what you believe to be true, not just about work, but about the world and what it means. So sometimes when I'm in the middle of coaching a client, a leader, and we're encroaching upon this territory, it can stir some pretty powerful emotions. It makes us uncomfortable. And just human beings being what we are, we would rather not be uncomfortable. The other thing is, it's cognitive energy, and our brains are kind of patterned to resist that work. So like, you want to learn how to play a bass guitar that you've never played, and you want to start learning that at 60, well, you're going to have some energy to overcome. It's not that you can't do it, but it takes some work. And that kind of plasticity applies to mindsets as well. So a combination of things. And I'll say one more thing. Mindsets are all around us. And if we are working with an environment where there's a shared, cohesive set of mindsets that we're comfortable with, then we get reinforced by those other human beings around us that hold similar mindsets. So breaking away can feel like a bit of being unorthodox. And for some people, that's pretty uncomfortable.
You mentioned that you've coached elite athletes and well as healthcare executives, lots in both categories, it sounds like to me. And I'm interested, what are some of the things the two groups have in common?
Great question. One thing that springs to mind is they both tend to be a pretty smart group of people, intelligent students of their craft. The second thing that comes to mind, they care about performing well at their peak and doing their very best. I don't know very many leaders who like to lose. I don't know very many elite athletes like to lose. The fourth thing that comes to mind, and I do mention this in one of the mindsets, maybe we'll get to it later on. And this is where they differ, might be interesting to our audience. Mm. Elite athletes, they train their body and their mind. And in that training, there is recovery. In fact, the improvement for an athlete bodily and mentally happens biologically during rest, not during the training. The training is the stress, the body recovers, and that's how it improves. But what I see leaders around me do is they think their improvement comes from the stress. I'll just work 15 hours a day. I'll just do more. And they ignore the fact that the very same body that allows elite athletes to perform is the one they're relying on to be an elite leader. It's just as physically demanding, emotionally demanding, spiritually demanding, relationally demanding, if not more, to be an elite leader as it is to be an elite athlete.
Fascinating. Shifting towards an orthodoxy, you say that healthcare organizations are complex and not just complicated. Can you help me with the distinction?
There's a couple key things to compare and contrast what I mean by complicated and complex. Let's start with what's most familiar to all of us. Complicated systems, they're reducible, which means I can break it down into small parts and focus on them. And if there's something wrong with that part, I can fix it. And then when I put it all back together again, the whole works. And if there's a small change in that part that's broken, then I would expect a small improvement in the whole. Or if there's a big problem in that part, I fix that, I would expect a big outcome or improvement in complicated. And they work predictably, meaning I know if I do A, do this thing, then what's going to happen is B. We know that that's what's going to happen next. In complex systems, there are so many interdependent relationships going on at any given time, feeding back on each other in a dynamic way. There's no way for us to know whether A is going to lead to B. It might lead to C. It might lead to Z. We don't know. And the second thing is, in complex organization, unique to these kind of situations or contexts, you can't reduce it. You try to reduce it, everything you remove is contributing to what's happening. And so you try to reduce it down and you create an artificial perspective or an artificial result that has nothing to do with what's actually going on the whole. Other people have said it this way: the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So we know we're in complex situations when there's a really high degree of uncertainty around us and the anxiety that stirs from us. That's a clue to us that something is complex. Or we try to fix something and the problem just keeps coming back. We've tried so many times in so many ways and it just doesn't make any difference. And we keep thinking there's a right answer. There are no right answers in complex situations. You have to work with what's unfolding instead of trying to fix what's unfolding. That's a down and dirty. There's much more in the book about those two things. It's the uncertainty that makes complexity particularly difficult to deal with.
I like that the word unorthodox is in your title, and it certainly seems like the healthcare system that we're trying to function with needs some changes, and some unorthodoxy would be appreciated. Mm-hmm. But it occurs to me that there may be times in a physician's career that it is ill-advised for him or her to be unorthodox. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And it goes to the heart of one of the concerns I had about framing the book the way that I did on calling something orthodox and unorthodox. And I tried to make the point at the beginning of the book and maybe at the end, hopefully along the way. This is not an either or decision, that orthodox thinking mindsets and unorthodox thinking and mindsets, they travel together. I like to think of it as it's additive. My concern is it seems that many leaders only have access to orthodox mindsets and the thinking that goes along with that. And what my invitation to the reader is, hold on to those. There's a place those are useful when things are straightforward, when you can reduce it and break it down. We've got some clinical protocols are pretty straightforward and they work. We know that. Like sometimes we'll talk about ventilator-associated pneumonia. That's a fairly complicated process that we can break down, and we know we can apply those theories at work. Retain that. It's important. But what's missing for me is the vast majority of the leadership work that we do, as executive leaders in particular, is solely in the complex environment. And we try to apply the principles that we're so familiar with in complex settings, and that's where things go sideways. And I think in the book, I say we break things. At least I commonly say when we try to apply thinking suitable to complicated environments and apply those to complex environments, then things break. People, processes, and organizations as a whole over time.
That was a great answer. You write about 10 different mindsets in the book, and we unfortunately don't have time to discuss them all. And this is why people should read your book, because they're very well thought through and set forth. But maybe you can describe one or two of them with perhaps some representative stories, just to give people a feel.
Yeah, let me start with one that carries a lot of juice for me. And we touched upon it already. It's, I don't know what number in the book. I think it's number 7. And it's in the part 3 of the book. The first one in part 3 called The First Work. What I call the first work of leadership. We call it the first work because it comes first. It's foundational. And work because it's work. This is the work of leadership that is attending to this physical body that we live in, and our mind, and our spirit, if you hold to that, and the relationships that matter to us. The neuroscience is pretty clear. If you're not well physically, mentally, emotionally, there is no way for you to perform at your best. That is true for athletes as much as it is for leaders. Yet, all around me, and, you know, honestly, I have to tell you, I live this myself. We don't pay attention to that. We think that, let's say, going to the gym, that's a sidebar thing. Like, if you can fit that into your life on the margin, it definitely fits in the life side. I don't like this framing, but it fits on the life side for most people, not the work side of the work-life balance. And this mindset that I offer is, that's backwards. If you want to perform at your best and tolerate the discomfort that comes with complex environments, you have to be well. It's not optional. And so that's why it's first. For me, for example, I get up at 4:30 in the morning. I'm on a bicycle almost every day at 5 a.m. In my mind, as soon as I step on the bike, that's the beginning of my workday. When people ask me, well, when do you start work? I say 5 a.m. Because sitting on the bicycle, riding, and working on my physical conditioning is work for me. It allows me to put in 12 and 15 hour days and travel around the world and write a book and do the things that are demanded from me and the leadership roles that I play. I think it's the same thing for healthcare leaders. And as a physician, a general internist, I'm deeply concerned about the implications for the way that we participate in leadership and its implications on our body and our mind and our relationships. So that's one that I have a lot of juice in. I could talk about more if you'd like, or we can just stay with that one.
Let's do one more, because they're so interesting. I can't help myself, please.
Okay. Well, I'll talk about another one. The other one is uncertainty. We mentioned it earlier about what makes complex environments so challenging for us is because the uncertainty is so high. Now, I think like most people, that's not news. But what might be news, new to me, is that there are actually different kinds of uncertainty. In the book, I named 4 different kinds of uncertainty. And we can do something about some of those, and we oftentimes do, but we can't do anything about some of them either. And so in the book, I talk about what's called reducible forms of uncertainty. These are forms of uncertainty, like if we just go learn more, or maybe we do better at prediction, creating prediction models, we can reduce the uncertainty that comes from that. But what we can't reduce are the uncertainty that comes from the inherent variation that occurs in any process. It's inescapable. And in complex environments, it's rampant. You can't change that because it's inherent to the system. It's not fixable. If you try to fix that, you will break complexity. If something is complex, that was a key learning point. And then the uncertainty that comes because we all make sense of the world differently. We all have a different belief set about what is real and how it works. And so mindsets play out in that as well. Can't reduce that either. That's inherent. Anytime we've got a whole bunch of people involved in what's going on around us, That creates uncertainty, and you're never going to get rid of that. And the more complex things are, the more those irreducible forms of uncertainty are present. The only thing you can do is, in the book, I use the word absorb it. You have to sit with it and be good with it. We hear it in the popular literature, this notion of being good with ambiguity. It's very similar. So I talk about those things and how important it is to recognize what kind of uncertainty am I feeling and where does it come from? Let me act on the things I can reduce. But the mistake is to try to reduce the forms of uncertainty that can't be reduced. And that causes all kinds of problems with people. I think it's one of the sources of harm for us. And we're actually telling people what to believe and what to think. And that gives me trouble, not only because I don't like somebody telling me that, but I wonder about the ethical and moral implications of that. So that's another one that was a lot of fun for me to write. And other leaders have found that to be really helpful for them to think through what's going on around them.
Dr. Hines, our time together draws to a close. I'm going to ask you to make the closing argument for your book, Shifting Towards an Orthodoxy. Why should physician leaders read the book, and how's it going to help them?
I'll start with why, go back to why I wrote the book. If you're like me, when I was in those executive roles and just troubled by what you saw going on around you, and you're participating in it, but you're unsettled by it, going, there's got to be a better way. Something about the way we're doing things is just not working. And I was curious what that would be. So why read the book? Well, here's a leader who's been in healthcare in various ways for 39 years and has worked with hundreds, if not thousands, of leaders in healthcare for the last 10 years. And this is how he is making sense of what might possibly be, why it's so hard, and what might I do to be better with what's going on around me. It's an invitation to think differently and an introduction to this notion of complexity and how it might apply to your day-to-day activities.
That was a great answer. My guest has been Dr. Michael Hine. The book is Shifting Towards an Orthodoxy. Michael Hine, thank you so much for being on Sound Practice.
It's been a joy. Thank you.
My thanks to Michael Hine. Dr. Hine's new book, Shifting Towards an Orthodoxy, is a thoughtful, detailed analysis for physician leaders. I highly recommend this book. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. Had his holy cow, Batman and Robin, Rick Capow.